Last week we had trouble with rain, which didn't bother you. This week we've had quite a bit more rain. How is the situation now?
Well, the rain hasn't done us any good at all, I'm afraid, because it's just not been enough to waterlog the ground to bring out the colour. It's simply drained straight away, and our problem's been wind. I suppose this is something most excavators don't run into, but in fact, on this particular site, we are exposed to a very strong wind, call it gale, coming in off the English Channel straight over the cliff. Last year it lifted a navvy's barrow fully loaded 6 feet over a man's head and dumped it 25 feet away. This year it's simply going round and round in eddies over the site, right through the valley, blowing all the dumps into the trench. And several occasions we had half an inch of dust over the entire site, which has had to be removed. Brushing, of course, has smeared all the features. So this has been no great help, and it has made it impossible on one day to work on the site at all, because one just could not loosen earth without it blowing away. So again, we had to abandon for an afternoon. The land itself we're digging on here has been bought only within the last 2, perhaps 3 years by National Trust as part of Operation Neptune. In fact, this isn't the only site on the land. I may have mentioned we have an Iron Age promontory fort running around the hill. We have at least one barrow which still survives. One went over the cliff. And curiously enough, within the last week, the National Trust have cut a new path, or reopened an old path more properly, through the gorse on the site, and we discovered yet another barrow, standing something like 6 feet high and completely undamaged. And in fact, I think it's a very wise policy that they should allow excavation on the site and this piece of research, as we know this site is also of outstanding interest to the naturalist, for a number of rare birds and so on here.
On September the 1st, just over halfway through the excavation, Richard Bradley gave details of the progress made in various parts of the site.
Well, during the last week, we've more or less completed our first strip of the site. That's to say, we've got down onto the beaker surface over the whole area. We started exposing features, and we've got a certain amount of material. This gives us enough to know through the first stage of the scheme which I outlined at the beginning, the technique we're using here. We've been able to build up five densities so far from the meter grid which we've laid down. Now the first of these is possible features, which rather speaks for itself, possible post holes and so on, which are things we have observed in a purely conventional way, soil changes and so on, possibly the tops of intrusions cutting into lower soil. The second of these is the density of finds, which are datable specifically as being of beaker culture type, that's to say pottery, finished implements and waste material. Other items which may have some bearing on, like selected pebbles, some seem to have been selected on the site, selected glacial erratics which may have been used as polishing stones. These two can be put onto a grid, but we've left them out for the moment because we can't give them a firm date. The third grid is of pitched flints, those flints that may have been, that are lying unnaturally, that are lying more or less upright, whereas naturally they would lie flat, which may have been filling features, say tipped into the filling of a pit or placed against the side of a post hole, and which have now been isolated by soil erosion by the sides of those holes washing away completely down the hill, being weathered away. Another grid we've done is the distribution of abnormally large flints. The basic geological matrix on the site is fairly uniform. There is a post-glacial flint seam with a certain amount of mesolithic material in it. But the flints of this are uniform and lie in a uniform fashion. So it is possible to isolate those larger flints that may have served as packing stones, or equally likely as thatch weights around the around a building, weighing down the thatch at the point where a conical thatch would meet the ground. These two can be isolated. And finally, the fifth grid is of pot boilers, of calcined flints that have been heated and have shattered in contact with cold water. Now, these can't be specifically dated as Beaker, though this is up to a point very likely. And we've superimposed these five grids. Now, each of these corresponds to a surprising degree. They suggest three basic areas, one just inside the surrounding earthwork and to the side of the enclosure entrance, the second one in the dead centre of our area, and the third one on the western edge as one runs down the valley. In each case, there seem to be breaks within the density grid which may correspond to some extent with the limits of buildings. Now, this doesn't work to the same extent in each case. In the case of the one first, which one reaches first, as one runs down the valley from the enclosure entrance, the one situated alongside the entrance, the fit is relatively approximate. It seems that there is an appreciably greater number of density of material within what we have suggested as the confines of the hut on conventional criteria. In the case of a central one, there appears to be a greater density, a much greater density, around the outside of the structure, as if the floor had been kept relatively tidy and the material had been thrown just outside. The third case, the grid isn't complete, so I can't really say anything about that. What bearing does this have on the work we've done before? Well, it seems to me that we now can accept two, probably three structures with a great deal of confidence. We do have one, possibly two further areas in which structures are likely, but finds are not yet forthcoming. Well, this may be because we've yet to go down. Certainly in the second spit we're doing, or the second level we're doing, we're all within one layer. There may be an increase in finds. It may alternatively be that these are false alarms, or quite as likely that these are non-domestic buildings. And it's tempting to think in terms of barns, granaries and other outbuildings, but evidence is needed for this. So that has been the main effect of work inside the enclosure. Outside the enclosure, we've started work on what we suspect to be a burial mound. We've reopened part of last year's excavation and extended outwards. It appears that mound, if mounds would be the right term, the mound is not circular, but rather more pear-shaped. We've cleared around its edges. We're now troweling off the surface of it to check an observation from last year which would suggest that it is perhaps rather more than a mound, a cairn of flints with larger ones placed around the outside as a form of curb. All one can say at the moment is that the mound seems to be extremely small and that at the edges of it we have got a certain amount of domestic refuse. We hope we'll be able to trace this rubbish layer, if such it is, underneath the surrounding earthwork of the enclosure, which of course it runs adjacent to the mound, and it may be possible even to tie it to one of our series of successive ditches. Well, during the next week we're going down the second time over the site, and this will provide us with another five grids, which we can then superimpose with the five we have already, and various others which we will be able to construct, but not on the site, ones that will need more work, particularly statistical work. And I hope that when the 10 go together, then we can come back and say we are so much percent certain of the existence of so many structures.
Can you tell us something about this method of photographing the grids?
Yes, this is nothing new. It's called photogrammetric planning. The principle is much the same as in more recent air survey. That is to say that one takes a number of vertical photographs of an area that's been cleaned from a constant height above. They are then formed as a mosaic. These are slightly overlapping. They're joined as a mosaic and turned into a composite photograph, generally by re-photography. We're doing this simply with three 20-foot scaffold poles as an improvised tripod, 20-foot extendable ladder, and we're taking our measurements simply by having a fixed plumb bob from legs, which legs are straddled until plumb bob reaches the requisite level. It is improvised, but it is necessary, I think, to have ready for publication such photographs of all the features which we're claiming, because since we are working on an eroded site, and since we are claiming as features, claiming to find post holes, claiming to find pits, in circumstances where conventionally these can't survive, I think it's only reasonable that our evidence should be photographic as well as our own plan. This probably adds a certain amount of objectivity into the work which we can't find otherwise.
This burial mound is rather unusual shape. Is there any possibility this could have been caused by anything but a burial mound?
Yes. I don't think we want to be too confident about it. After all, we looked at what we thought was less than half of it last year, and we found a mound which had a circular perimeter. But this year, the circular perimeter isn't exactly behaving in laws of geography, of geometry, I should say. And it is less a very flattened circle. It's hard to see another explanation for it, unless it be that it is waste flint from clearing an area for cultivation. It might just be a stack of that. On the other hand, it does bear a strong resemblance to cairns of flint which have been found on the Sussex flint mining sites. These are very much of this period, as far as we know at present. For instance, Churchill at Findon, which is one such site within this general group around Worthing, did produce a rusticated beaker that's of a type which would now be thought to be a domestic beaker. We did at one stage wonder whether any part of the enclosure were ploughed, and in fact we took four half sections through the limit of the flint seam, which has been exposed by erosion, by scouring, wind, rain, weathering, on the sides of the valley, which seemed a week ago to be producing something of an unnatural scarp as it dropped away, which we thought might be the result of ploughing behind one or more of the structures. Now, looking at this closer, it appears that this flint matrix has also been dispersed as it runs down, and is probably a difference in degree of soil erosion, and I don't think we need bring in ploughing. Also, we've managed to find a second structure sitting in what would have been the field, so I think we must drop this idea. We've continued finding pottery. Again, we have this curious phenomenon. It is specifically coarseware, it is specifically domestic pottery, and it forms some contrast to the pottery associated with the structure which we excavated last year. Implements continue to be prolific and continue to be distributed together, greatly concentrated about possible structures and distributed by function. Woodworking equipment together, arrowheads are lodged together. But we have much too small a sample for this necessarily to be significant. I think we put much more significance on the distinctions in the pottery, which may reflect social distinctions. One curious fact is that we have no flaking floors as yet, whereas we had several in a much smaller area on the valley side last year. Among the implements, I don't think many call for comment. They are perfectly typical. They're very attractive. We have particularly fine barbed and tanged arrowhead, which has just turned up. Also an unfinished leaf-shaped arrowhead. A mesolithic pick. But I don't think we want to be carried away by the fact that they're attractive, because the method we're using really demands that they are merely one stage in an argument which also involves all the waste material. And for this reason, we are keeping every single piece of waste, plates and cores, and indeed pot boilers, to see how many of those are struck flakes that have been subsequently in contact with fire. And from this, I hope we can reconstruct the industry in great detail, because far too many flint industries have been published so far without associated pottery, or alternatively, groups of pottery have been published without associated flint industries. And so the correlation between pottery styles and flints is far from exact. Rather puzzled by one major point which won't emerge, I think, within the excavation, that is, we have a very large enclosure, one that is, say, 450 feet across, probably rather more. because we've lost some site, parts of it to coastal erosion. Now, there are two possibilities with this. We call it a village and then divide up the material in it by function. Perhaps have flint knappers in one part, artisans in other parts. But this speaks much too much of an urban economy and doesn't really seem to fit the facts as we're finding them. There is also the possibility that when we call this a village, we are calling a village something which was only occupied for perhaps 6 months in the year, and that the usage of this site may be seasonal. Well, in favour of this, one might cite the number of successive earthworks, a number of recuts of the surrounding enclosure. Against this, one might cite the fact that the distribution of finds, where one has seen two levels, the surface and the bottom, that is only to say within the reopened trench area of last year's trench, is precisely constant, precisely the same. Likewise, there do not appear to be any rebuilds of structures or overlapping structures, which might suggest that things are more permanent. Also, I think the nature of the structures argues a certain permanency in itself. On the other hand, were it a possibility that there were seasonal occupation, then it might be that another reason why structures don't overlap each other is that a very large enclosure was concerned largely with taking stock, and that each time a slightly separate area was occupied. Very much the principle one has in Iron Age cemeteries, where one can almost work out a chronological sequence on the principle that one doesn't bury a person where someone else was buried, and you go right through the site, from one site to the other. Since, in fact, we're not going to be able to establish whether this is correct or not, I don't think we'll be able to base any sequence of finds or structures upon it. Our main hope, I think, lies with further look at the surrounding earthwork, which we're now starting to section at one further point, an examination of the microscopic land mollusca, land snails, which are associated with each recut, to find out to what degree each of these ditches had been overgrown between recuts. Also, samples of soil to find out the nature of soil formation within the ditch and bank, and to hope from this that we can estimate the period of time which has elapsed between the successive recuts. For two alternatives, you see, that they were here for 6 months of the year, perhaps long enough probably to plant a crop and harvest it, and partly to carry out seasonal activities on the shoreline. We do have this midden, which contained a large number of winkle shells in the non-acidic layer in the midden that Toms found in 1909. The other alternative is that this was a permanent site. I would personally favour this, which departs from a nomadic model. I think it's a little hard to see people who are in a place long enough to plant a crop and harvest it moving about. I think this is really the relic of an older view of these people, which wouldn't allow them permanent settlements at all, and wouldn't allow them permanent houses either, but put them in tents. You see, we have gone from a view of Bika folk which makes them nomads who have no particular home, which is largely based on our inability to find domestic structures, to a view of them as much more stationary people with a much more developed economy, supporting themselves to a much greater degree by the sort of agriculture that one had originally thought didn't develop until the middle, later Bronze Age and Iron Age. And I think the truth will lie between the two, but on this site, I think the nature of the site, the fact that it's enclosed, militates very much against it being a seasonal site, one that's only visited occasionally, particularly since the material is comparatively narrowly defined, because we have looked at a lot of fields on Beachy Head and a lot of material, and the fact is that specifically beaker material is not especially common. This site seems to be very much a nucleus in its own, whereas late Neolithic material is abundant in every field. I think the contrast can be made out in this way, that in many of the fields on Beachy Head, most of them in fact, polished axes have been found. We don't even have a polished axe sharpening flake. various other purely Neolithic forms, in the old sense of Neolithic, have appeared on Beachy Head, which do not appear upon this site at all. Whereas along the pottery here, we have little but beaker pottery. We have four sherds of late Neolithic grooved ware. Apart from this, the pottery is entirely and specifically beaker, with the exceptions of rather later material, for example, fragments of food vessels. So I would suggest from this that the site is narrowly confined, and narrowly confined even amongst its own neighbours. I think this may be that it is a small ethnic enclave, and thus a permanent settlement. But this takes a lot of arguing, and there are objections to be put to this, and, as I say, most of this must await detailed work in the laboratory.
At the end of the digging site, we asked Richard to cover the main points again in the light of these new discoveries.
I think this work already shows some simple implications for our knowledge of this period. In the first place, we have now excavated a substantial segment of a beaker settlement, which is indeed on a valley bottom, the very area where for so long we have been expecting to find domestic occupation. We've shown by our finding of four houses in a situation where soil erosion certainly did take place and on a severe scale, that in certain instances, a case like this where ploughing does not seem to have taken place within the enclosure, it is still possible to define the probable sites of domestic buildings, even though the post holes and the bedding trenches are very nearly lost with soil erosion. And this may encourage further work on further sites. Finally, we have on this site at least four domestic structures, which is twice the number found on any site in this country before. We have with these evidence, detailed evidence for economy. So too, this site is in direct association with what can only be a burial mound. All too often, under burial mounds, we have found domestic debris, as we've done here. But this has been explained away as the result either of funeral feasts or as ritual deposits of occupation earth, of deposits of debris from the dead man's hearth. With the finding of this barrow, in an intimate association with the settlement, perhaps these sites will need a further look. Again, we found that it is possible to define structures, even despite soil erosion, though we have few post holes, few bedding trenches surviving in a conventional way, it is still possible to find the outlines of structures with some degree of probability. The only factor which has made this site abnormal, apart from perhaps its valley sighting, is the absence of evidence for ploughing. And this may act as a spur for future work. Finally, we have a larger number of huts on this site than on any other beaker settlement site that has so far been excavated in this country. And though we lack animal bones, with these huts we do have plentiful evidence for the economy that was practiced within the settlement. With this in mind, this site can stand temporarily as a type site for the period, and in the longer term as a challenge for further work.